This is the Blaze Radio on demand.
Readers.com is your one-stop shop for quality reading glasses with over 700 styles under $20. Readers.com offers bifocal readers, reading sunglasses, computer readers, and more with powers from 1.0 to 6.0. With free shipping on orders over $30, friendly customer service, and easy returns, you are sure to find your perfect pair. Enter the coupon code BUCK at checkout for 30% off your next order. That's Readers.com. Happy eyes, happy wallet.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is 3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to the Freedom Hut. Thank you so much for joining. Appreciate you being here. Great to have a chance to chat with you on this Monday morning, or Monday afternoon, rather. Just technically turned into afternoon. You'll also notice I'm a little under the weather. Apologies for that. My voice is, I'm going to push through. Shields high. Be fine. I just am a little hoarse. I got a little sick over the weekend. So, apologies. It also means that I did a little test run. I was like, can I still do the Hillary voice? And it just, instead of sounding like Hillary, a bad impersonation that's yet still awesome of Hillary Clinton, it just sort of breaks off into a screech, and there's no real sound that comes out. So I can't really do much in the way of vocal gymnastics today, but I have a lot of content, a lot of time to, or a lot of things to speak to you about, and looking forward to getting into all of that with you. And maybe having a voice in about two registers lower, maybe some of you are like that. I don't know. So perhaps it's soothing for those listening to the podcast in the evening time. Be like, so just kick back, relax, pour that glass of Pinot Noir and kick back while I soothe you with my tones of freedom. Something like that, right? That would work. So I wanted to take a very broad view, or step back and take a very broad view of what I see going on right now, which is, I guess, what I do day in and day out here. But instead of following the lead of every news organization, which you're just going to see poll, 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 you know, who's going to win Indiana? It's such a pivotal race. Cruz's last stand. I could write all the headlines for them right now. I mean, you know, they don't even have to send me a check. I'll just do it for them. Will the Donald Trump cruise in Indiana? I mean, you can see all this stuff. But I was thinking about some other stuff for the weekend. I've been doing some research recently on my own for a project on totalitarianism and authoritarianism, and essentially, dictatorship, government where you have no rights. There's just power, and you're told what to do. That's the one thing that sort of brings all of that together. And what's been interesting is that some other, you know, given the current climate, and that's, I know a lot of people would think largely a function of Trump and his success. And so you step back for a moment, and you say, hold on, is this really just about Donald Trump? Are you one of these people that thinks that Trump is a fascist? And I think it's actually much, much bigger than that. And I'm not arguing the Trump issue one way or another right now. I think that based on what we see, not just in this, not just in this election, but culturally, when you look at the mass psychology of this country, it seems more and more like we are clamoring for a king. I mean, we really just want to have someone to fix it for us. We're going to give them the power to do it. We don't care what the laws say. We don't really even care what the... And when I say we, I don't mean you and me. I mean enough of the American people that this is a real concern. Enough of the American people that we have to be realistic. They may outvote you and me. There may actually be more of them now. It's daunting, and I don't mean to sound overly sour here on Monday about what's going on, but I want to be honest with you. This is what I see happening. And I'm not the only one. In fact, there were a couple of pieces, and this is something I've been looking at for months, and reading about the rise of dictatorship. You know, I don't like to talk about Hitler and the Nazis because it's sort of a crutch for a lot of people. They're the Nazis. But the rise of fascist dictatorship in Nazi Germany as sort of a the politics of it and how it worked in the earlier phases, I find fascinating. And I think that there are some lessons to be taken from that. Not lessons as in that's what's happening now, but you can start to see very clearly the indicators, right? It's a very good exemplar of how a very advanced society, which Germany was at the time, even for its time, Germany was a place of tremendous culture and industrial achievement, and how does it descend into chaos? And I shouldn't say chaos, actually. That came later. How does it descend into darkness? That's a much better way of putting it. So I've been reading up on that and a few other things, and dictatorships. And it's fascinating to read about these dictators. I know one thing that often comes up is, who is the biggest threat to a dictator, to an autocrat, right? Who threatens the autocrat? And as every autocrat will tell you, as every dictator will tell you, every monarch, everybody, anyone who has concentrated and essentially absolute power, although there's really no such thing as absolute power, right? You know, even the most bloodthirsty authoritarian, even Kim Jong-un, if he were to order the murder of every single one of his top generals, I think that all of a sudden there'd be something rather noxious in his cornflakes, and Kim Jong-un would be no more. But if you look at authoritarians and you break down from a sort of political science perspective, who's the threat? I mean, you really look at it and look at this, and I've been doing this. I've been looking at some of the statistics on this. It's those around the person in power, obviously. It's that first inner circle. That's who you have to be most concerned about, which anyone who watches Game of Thrones, which I did watch last night, will tell you, enemies close, friends closer. And that's certainly true for those who maintain power through fear, through violence, through mechanisms other than a perception of legitimacy, right? So back to this perception of legitimacy thing, I'm seeing more and more that there are people who, and this is on the left, and this even, you look at the reactions from the correspondence dinner over the weekend, which I won't spend much of your time, waste much of your time on it. I covered the correspondence dinner. It was a journalist covering a bunch of journalists, as I've said. It's very meta on the weekend, and I was out late for that, and I assume maybe that's why I'm sick. But the way that I can see both on social media gives you a window into a segment of society, but if you know how to read it, it's sort of like becoming a pollster after a time, right? You can get a sense. Like when I'm doing this show with you, for example, if one of you tweets at me, I don't like this topic, that doesn't really, depends on who it is, of course. Some of you I've been with for a long time, but generally speaking, one person. But if three of you say, this is kind of boring, or you should move on to this, or hey, you really need to hit this topic. Well, that's only three people based on the sample size, based on, who tweets at me and on Facebook as well. I have a good sense of what's going on, right? And looking over the weekend, what I realize is, there's a sense now in a post-Obama, soon to be a post-Obama era, that's what the people want. That's what journalists want. It's what Americans, now I say Americans, maybe it's only 51%, but enough to impose it on the rest of us. That seems to be what they want. One person who is endowed with powers that exceed the Constitution, that can effectively abrogate congressional authority, that can eliminate the barriers that were very carefully put into place at the founding for exactly this problem, to avoid this problem of executive authority. You have pieces over the weekend that I saw, and I've been talking about this for weeks, and I'm honestly researching this because I'm also planning to do, well, I'm planning to write on this at length, because I think this is what's happening in this country. And by the way, as it happens more here, you'll see this happening more and more around the world as well. And I think you could make the argument that it is, that democracy in the Middle East is something that not only is not in keeping with our interests necessarily, I'm not sure it's in keeping with the interests of a majority of the people in many of these countries, which in a lot of cases in the Middle East, of course, are just constructs anyway, sort of leftovers from the past, borders and boundaries drawn by people who had the power at the time to do it. And now those boundaries are in some cases being erased, like in Syria and Iraq. But do we really want there to be just free and fair elections? Whoever wins, wins. I don't think that's honestly going to be the way that it goes for us. We realize now more and more that that's not a good thing. So in the American context, though, people are particularly there's a sense of growing concern about this as we go into the election season. And this, by the way, I can say this, 2012, this was not a discussion we were having. 2008, this is not a discussion that I remember anyone having. 2004, this is something new. And it seems to have happened rather quickly, as many things have happened rather quickly. The culture has changed so much under the 8 years of Obama that the political culture, but also just the culture of what we can say, what we can do, how we speak to each other, what's considered acceptable conduct, what falls under the broad rubric of things like religious freedom. That's all changing so rapidly that it's hard to keep pace with it. And it just is something that now has its own momentum. You have New York Magazine, there was a piece, America has never been so ripe for tyranny. I think it was Andrew Sullivan writing. In the New York Times, you had Ross Douthat, who is a conservative. And he writes a piece, Give Us a King. I'm not the only one who sees it. This is out there now. And it's not just a Trump thing. And that's what I really want to make sure everyone's very clear on. It's not just a Trump thing. I mean, we have Ted Cruz, a limited constitutionalist. I'm sorry, limited government constitutionalist, not a limited constitutionalist. He just likes little pieces of the Constitution here and there. No, a limited government constitutionalist. And he hasn't been able to get the support yet. I know we have to see what happens in Indiana tomorrow. But, I mean, guys, gals, let's be honest with each other. It's going to be a steep uphill climb even to prevent Trump, I think, at this point from getting the 1237 before the nomination. There are pieces coming out showing that delegates who are unbound, yeah, they're unbound, and they were going against Trump, but now, you know, they're kind of going which way the wind is blowing, and the wind is blowing Trump's way. But this isn't a problem of just Trump at all. I think Trump in some ways, or I think he very clearly highlights the problem and makes it something that, you know, because a lot of his supporters do seem to have this notion in their heads that he can do things that he just clearly can't, right? That there are, that Trump will be able to accomplish changes in this country that no president would be able to unless they were to dramatically exceed their authority. And I think they'd be okay with that, right? I think they would be fine with it. You know, the more you, you know, and when Trump says things like he wants to make it hard, you know, easier to sue media companies for libel and all this sort of thing. The fact of the matter is that it's not just the Trump supporters who are out there right now saying that they want somebody who has the authority to change the way that our government works, to eliminate the constraints and the boundaries established by the Constitution, and that, yes, have been, you know, there's been give and take going on a couple of centuries now, but point being, they've been there. I think they're eroding, and it's not just one administration, and it's not just one moment in time. I think the American people find themselves in a place where there's so little that unites us politically and increasingly culturally as well, that there is perhaps a majority, we'll see, that just wants someone in charge who has enough power to make everybody who doesn't agree with them, whoever it is that falls under that umbrella, enough power to make the other guys do what they want. They want somebody who will tell them what to do. It's a very powerful human psychological need, right? A lot of people want to be told what to do. Without turning this into a discussion about any particular religion, a lot of people want to submit and be told what to do. Some religions are named for submission. So, you know, people want to be told what to do. That is something that's there, and I think we all fight against in our own ways. But it's easier. It's actually easier to surrender to that. And I see this now. And it's with Hillary, too. And it's with Bernie. And it's with a lot of the people that I see supporting Trump. There is this desire right now to have one person who just gets it all done, fixes all the problems, uses the massive apparatus of the bureaucracy to exceed what anyone with normal expectations could ever think would happen. But people want that. And if you really want that and you'll vote for that and you won't make any noise when principles are violated and you won't make any noise when constitutional restraints on executive power are cast aside, it's just a self-fulfilling prophecy. All the momentum right now is going in that direction. It's all towards centralization of authority. It's all towards a winner-take-all politics, which is the way it works in much of the world, by the way. We have been the anomaly, right, with our contested government. And, yeah, there are parliamentary democracies, and you know, there are other places, sure. But, by the way, in many of those countries, they're effectively one-party states for decades at a time. And so there's that. But also, here we've always, at least supposed to, we've supposed to be in this place, supposedly had this sense. There were some things, some lines that even if we really wanted to, we would not cross. Some powers, some authority that we would never want anyone to have. And that that was an essential part of our government apparatus. I see people now who don't care. They want the great Obama. They want the magnificent Hillary. They want the unbelievable Trump. They want this. They want someone who steps forward and tells them what to do. Somebody who takes power. Sure, maybe they won't like everything they do, but they promise to make the pain, the problems, go away. If only you give them all the authority they could ever dream of. I think it's very dangerous. And I put this on the American people. Demagogues only have an audience because people aren't paying close enough attention to the truth. And there are demagogues aplenty right now. There are demagogues in media. There are demagogues in politics. And I think we're heading down a very dangerous path when it comes to our sense of what the government should be. That's my moment of cheer for Monday for all of you. I got to switch gears for a second to our sponsor right now. I want to welcome to the Buck Sexton Show, YHM. That's Yankee Hill Machine. YHM designs, develops, and manufactures top quality firearms and accessories right here in the USA. YHM is a third-generation family-owned company who are proudly celebrating their 65th anniversary in business. From humble beginnings in Florence, Massachusetts, you see, YHM started as a simple job shop. They just were making cleaning kits for the U.S. government, and they modeled their first rifle after a reproduction of a black powder musket. Now, a lot's changed since 1951, but YHM's commitment to quality, performance, and value hasn't changed a bit. Current owners Chris and Kevin Graham stay true to the family tradition, and they produce some of the finest rifles and sound suppressors on the market. Their continued innovations have made YHM a strong force in the AR-15 and more recently even in the sound suppression industry. For the complete line of YHM products, go to YHM.net, YHM.net. Again, that is YHM, Yankee Hill Machine, YHM.net. Back after the break.
You're listening to The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Hey team, what's up? So, as I was saying, my by the way, I'm inviting you now to come take a warm bath in my vocal jazz. Yeah. Sounds kind of like that, I know. That's a Ron Swanson Duke Silver reference, by the way, for those of you who may not have caught that very obscure part. I need to stop watching Parks and Rec because I've seen it now like three times over the whole, all five seasons or whatever. But yeah, no, I'm sorry about the voice, guys. It's a little different than it should be, than it usually is. One thing I will say is that because we're not taping anymore the radio show and doing post-production as a TV show, the good news, team, is I can take your calls whenever. So that means the phone lines, which were always open in the past, but I had to have people hold usually until we got past the TV portion. Now they're open whenever. So first hour, if you want to call in and chat about anything I've said, you want to tell me that you think I was being unfair to Trump in the last segment, despite the fact that I mentioned Sanders and Hillary and Obama and the general whims of the American people on both sides of the political aisle, and that this has been going on now, I think, pre-Trump. This is centralization. Maybe I'll get into why I think there's centralization. That would be a good way to do it, maybe in the next block. I mean, I could also talk about polls, but that's not really the most exciting thing I've ever heard in my life. I wish I had more vocal range, but when I try to go up here, guys, sorry, it sounds a little strained. As you can tell, I could use your help, team. 888-900-3393. Phone lines are open. We'll be open all 3 hours of the show today and every day going forward. You can also send me messages at facebook.com/BuckSexton. We'll talk a bit more about politics and then the five-year anniversary of the Bin Laden raid and all kinds of good stuff, team. Stay with me.
Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network.
The founder of this company 10 years ago was trying to sell his house. He's, you know, he's kind of an important guy. And he said to his wife, if this is what it's like for us, how do people who have no clout ever get around this? So he started a company and it went into business, I think, 3 years ago. Their deal is their word is their bond. And they are people that listen to the show. They are just like you. Now, how can I say that? Because I'm the founder of the company. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
Well, now we can get into a little bit of the updates on politics, my friends, what's actually happening in the race right now, such as it is. As you know, Indiana's tomorrow. It is, I think, I mean, the headlines about this being the last stand for Cruz, if Cruz wins, I think we're going contested. If he loses, it depends on, of course, what the margins are. But, I mean, if he loses, I think it's likely that Trump will be able to get there. Keep in mind that it also matters to the unbound delegates, right? That they could, if they see that Cruz can't even win Indiana, they may say, you know what, we got to go with Trump. So whatever the current number is, if he adds to it with a win in Indiana, he can also add further delegates that currently aren't counted in the Trump column because they believe that's where it's going. Now, there's also, of course, the line of thinking here that Cruz will win and that we'll go to a contested convention. And if we get to a contested convention, I do think that very good chance that Cruz will win that, and then he'll go up against Hillary. And I just can't imagine, well, I shouldn't say things like I can't imagine, because of course I can, but if the American people vote for Hillary Clinton, unfortunately, the only thing I can say about it is, well, we will have to suffer the consequences of that decision if 51% of us, or some number close to it, votes for Hillary Clinton. That's where we're going. Now, let's sort of, there we go. Let's hear a little bit of what the latest is. You got Donald Trump is, of course, going to be saying that the establishment in Indiana, not to include Bobby Knight, by the way, who is for Trump. Bobby Knight, who said that we need somebody along the lines of, I think he said, what was it, along the lines of Truman, who will drop nukes to save billions of Americans. Whatever. Pretty sure there weren't billions of us, but, you know, I don't mean to be that guy who's focused too much on the details. So I'm a details kind of guy. I have like one register right now. I apologize. There's nowhere else for my voice to go. I was actually even planning on bringing Commie Bear back today, but right now Commie Bear would sound, he would sound too drunk. It would not be good. It would not work. But Donald Trump thinks that the establishment is pro-Cruz in Indiana. And of course that's true. And he spoke about Governor Mike Pence endorsing Ted Cruz. Play clip 7.
The Bobby Knight thing was really big. I thought that totally neutralized the Governor Pence quasi-endorsement of Ted Cruz, which had a lot of impact otherwise.
Sure. And the governor's a nice guy, but a lot of pressure was put on him by his donors. And, you know, he had to do it. But he was nicer to me. I mean, everyone thought he gave me the endorsement because he started off Donald Trump. I really want to thank him. And he's been great. And then he finished with me.
Right.
And somewhere in between, he said he'll vote for Cruz. But you could see that was not a real loving endorsement.
Not a loving endorsement. And then Donald Trump then mentioned whether he thinks the RNC will take the nomination from him. Play clip 8.
What are you going to do if you're 20 short and they try to screw you?
Well, look, I have 4 million votes more. Nobody ever talks about that. In fact, you're saying, I just saw in your show, that I have a record. I'm over 10 million votes. By next week, it'll be the biggest in the history of Republican primaries. And I'll end up, after California, having maybe 5 million more than anybody's ever had. Nobody's ever had these numbers before. And I'm up by 400 delegates or more than that. And wouldn't it be ridiculous if you don't get it in the first ballot and then a guy that had 5 million votes less? Because by the time it ends, it'll be 5 or 6 million votes less.
There you go. That's the Trump version of events. So there's that going on. Meanwhile, Ted Cruz is getting a lot of pressure from the media to already, you know, I have to love this game, right? Right at the critical juncture, you know, this would be like walking up before the Super Bowl to two teams and asking, you know, before Tom Brady and Eli Manning square off, be like, Eli, when Tom Brady wins tonight, are you going to give him a big hug after the game? Now it's sports and it's Eli Manning. I mean, sorry. Eli or Peyton. We can go either way. And so maybe they'd say yes. But it's kind of a weird thing to do, right? I mean, I think that would be strange. We wouldn't expect two quarterbacks to walk out and speak about, you know, we wouldn't expect one to speak about how excited he'll be when the other one wins before the game, like right before the game. I mean, it's one thing a week before the game or, you know, but right before the contest, right before the deciding moment, you're going to try to get inside these guys' heads and say, yeah, why don't you just say how awesome it's going to be when the other guy wins? And I have to tell you, the media games that are played. You had Ted Cruz and Chuck Todd going back and forth on this issue. And he really just wants to hear Ted Cruz say, you know, I mean, if Donald Trump wins, you're going to support him, right? Now, that's a fair question at a certain time and in a certain context. I mean, we've been asked, candidates have been asked before if they would take the pledge. They've been asked, you know, will they support the eventual nominee? But when you have one contest 48 hours away that's going to probably determine the future of the entire GOP primary, I don't think either candidate particularly wants to be forced to talk on national TV about how much they'll support the other candidate. It's just not the time for it, right? So, I mean, I can understand why Senator Cruz was a little terse when pushed on this. Play clip two.
I understand what you believe in the Republican Party. Can you support him? Can you tell your delegates,
Chuck, support
Chuck, Donald Trump? Well, you may not.
Chuck,
you realize
I recognize that many in the media would love for me to surrender to Donald Trump.
It's about the numbers. He may win. Republican voters are the ones rejecting you. This is not a media conspiracy, Senator.
Well, actually, with all due respect, the media has given $2 billion of free advertising to Donald. Let me ask you a question, for example. How much money did the networks make on every one of the Republican debates?
I have no idea,
right?
Because we didn't have a Republican debate.
But you know what's interesting, Chuck? It's been now 49 days since we've had a Republican debate. The Democrats have had a debate. Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, they've been willing to debate. Donald can't answer questions about his foreign policy. He can't answer questions about how you bring jobs back to the country.
Why can't you answer the question of whether you can support Donald Trump or not?
Why? Because he doesn't want to be talking about how he's a Trump supporter 2 days before the Indiana primary that'll determine basically who's likely to win the rest of the race. But also notice the little jab that was landed there when he said that, you know, Republican voters are the ones rejecting you. That's not really what's happening, right? Even if they're voting, even if Trump has won, you know, one more delegates in one or more states, as we know, Trump has gotten less than 50% of the vote overall from Republicans. So less than half the Republican Party has voted for this guy. More than half of the Republican Party says they won't get behind him. But, you know, and it's funny, he complains about the system all the time. If the system, say, had a limit to the number of candidates that could be run, for example, if the system had said, no more than 10, forget this 17 stuff, I do not believe Trump would be the nominee. If the system had said that every state was going to be proportional to the vote in terms of delegates awarded, I do not believe that Trump would be ahead, nor would he be the nominee. I mean, there are plenty of aspects of the system that have dramatically benefited the Trump campaign, right? If all of the delegates for candidates who have dropped out, Marco Rubio, were able to go to somebody else. I mean, there are so many things that you could point to here. Go to somebody else right away. They could just say, you know what, we're going to go. We're throwing our support behind so-and-so. So the system has really benefited the Trump campaign in a lot of ways, but they still say the system is terrible. And people want to just believe that the system is terrible. And maybe, you know, maybe, I don't know. I mean, is it a great system? You could, this is, whenever you're at a loss, just go for the first Churchill quote that comes to mind, right? Democracy is, you know, the worst system we have except for all the other ones. Fair way to put it, I think, when it comes to the way that we elect presidents in this country. I mean, it's a bad system, but I mean, what's the better system? Somebody tell me where they think the lowest. I guess you could tweak it here and there, but I digress. Interesting polls, though, that I wanted to point out for a second. This one I was not expecting, and this is going to be. Look, I do not lie to you. I do not shade the truth because it's easier for me, and there's no way for me to talk about this without pointing out the implications, I think, of what it will mean for tomorrow and for the rest of the race. You got a new Rasmussen poll, and look, Rasmussen is a pollster's pollster, right? And this is what he does. Scott Rasmussen, he's been at this a long time, and I think he's considered to be, you know, his calling card is accuracy of polls, not, you know, some polls that like some people more than others. And you got Trump at 41%, Clinton at 39%. Pretty amazing, actually. Trump at 41, Clinton at 39. 15% prefer some other candidate, and 5% are undecided. But if the election were held, this is the first time that Trump has led since October. This is the first time since October that if Trump went head-to-head against Hillary. Now, all the polls you had been seeing before this showed a huge lead for Hillary, and that was one of the big selling points for the Cruz campaign, I think, to those who were somewhat undecided. Now we're seeing a change. This poll is more important, I think, and now how many people will see it and how many people, although I do think right now it's linked on Drudge, and many are going to be like, yeah, big surprise there. It's the top of the Drudge Report in red. But this is going to, the Trump surrogates are going to be on TV all over the place. They're going to be talking about this. And I think what you're going to see is that this is a more effective talking point going into Indiana than any endorsement from, I think Mike Tyson has endorsed Donald Trump now, which I don't know what to say about that. Bobby Knight has endorsed Donald Trump. I mean, they really have some pretty astonishing, a pretty astonishing lineup of people who are like, yeah, I'm for Trump. And the Trump campaign is enthusiastic about this, I guess. I mean, you can't stop people from publicly endorsing you, right? But some of the people have come out of the work. It's amazing. You know, it's like, is the Iron Sheik still around from the WWF back in the day? Is he still, you got to be careful with wrestlers. A lot of them, unfortunately, are no longer with us. And then a few of them have had some really rough stuff going. Superfly Jimmy Snuka was, I think, wasn't he arrested for murder? Yeah, arrested for murder 30 years after the fact. Who knew? So anyway, but yeah, maybe the Iron Sheik or Sergeant Slaughter or one of those guys will throw their weight in with the Trump campaign too. I don't know. I mean, why not? At this point, the more the merrier, I suppose. But this is a very important poll. It's important right now. When I say it's important, I'm not saying it means that Trump will in fact beat Hillary. I don't know. Nobody knows. But for the perception right now of Trump's electability vis-a-vis Hillary, it's huge because and somebody like John Kasich has been going on, you know, I'm the one who could, I'll try to do my Kasich voice even though I can, I'm the Prince of Peace and I'm going around, and, you know, I'm talking policy and I'm great and I'm John Kasich and blah, 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 blah. And now it's like, oh, and I'm the only one who beats Trump in head-to-head, or beats Clinton in head-to-head. I'm the only, now that's not true anymore. So maybe he'll stop talking. Wouldn't that be kind of nice? Maybe Kasich will go back to being governor of Ohio, because he did it in Ohio, FYI. 888-900-3393. Team Buck, I need vocal backup today on the show. That means all of you. What do you think about, how do you think Indiana is going to go down tomorrow? What are your expectations? What do you think about this Trump beating Hillary poll? You buying it? It's essentially saying a lot of Democrats are going to go on the Trump train. Could that be? Is that the key? Is that how we actually have some form of Republican, theoretical or otherwise, in the White House in 2017. I want to hear your thoughts. 888-900-3393. Now, as we go into break, let me spin the latest Kenny G album for all of you out there. It's time for you to kick back, relax, pour some Chardonnay, And Buck's going to put on some Kenny G for all you ladies out there. I don't know. Do ladies like Kenny G? I don't know. This is like my NPR voice that maybe isn't working. Back after the break.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Discover more at theblaze.com/radio.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Dispensing the truth. This is Buck Sexton
on the Blaze Radio Network.
All right, team. We have some calls up here. Esther in Texas, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Welcome.
Well, hello, Buck. How are you?
I'm a little sick. Other than that, I'm great. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm good. Thank you. What's up?
One thing.
Sure.
My conjecture is that Trump is the only candidate that has the resources, both money and capital, to bribe and cajole for votes, to bribe and cajole pollsters, as unbiased as they claim to be, and to bribe and cajole delegates. Why is the media not looking at that angle? Could it be
I'm pretty sure that bribery is illegal. So, I mean, and I know people laugh when I say things like that, but no. I mean, if you give people money to vote for you, that you actually will go to prison. It's not like super PACs that may or may not coordinate it. Everyone's like, ha ha ha. If you give somebody if you promise somebody cash or gifts to vote for you, not allowed to do that. So I don't think Esther, that's.
He has claimed that Cruz has bribed delegates.
Yeah, I mean, what he says that, what he means by that, what he means by that, I think, is, you know, that he's, sort of schmoozing them. And, I mean, buying votes is illegal. Buying delegates is a little bit different. There are some gifts that, you know what? That's a good place to go. Esther, let me look at that point. And I'll come back to this on the other side of the break. You raise an interesting question here. What can be done to get delegates to come over? All right, team. 888-900. And Esther, thank you for calling. Phone lines are open. 888-900-3393. We got much more coming in hour two. Stay with me, team.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network. Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome back to the Freedom Hut. Thank you very much for joining. Later on in the show, we might do an additional hour where I introduce you to all kinds of freeform jazz. I should do some recordings now. You know, I could do like my own voiceovers. And now, the Buck Sexton Show. All right, onto some business. So, the question asked by Esther in Texas, I have to say, is a very good one. It's an even better one than I had at first realized. What I said about how you can't just bribe people—that's true, as a general principle, right? So, if somebody hands a delegate a bag of cash, and that's caught on, you know, video or something, that's a problem. You're going to run afoul of FEC regulations, but the problem with a convention, or problem, I suppose, it depends on who you ask, is what counts as a bribe? Well, what is a bribe? As I see here, there's a pretty interesting analysis written about this on CNN, and it's the title is Could Republican Convention Delegates Be Bought? And it says, legally, maybe. You know that buying votes is illegal, right? You can't walk around and give somebody, you can't say, here, here's $20, go vote for me. But the first line of this is buying votes is illegal, but it turns out buying delegates might not be. So there are federal and state laws that prohibit bribery of elected officials. But what private citizens serving as delegates at the party's conventions can take in exchange for their votes is a little more murky. So, yeah, there is a lot of leeway here. There's going to be gray area for sure. For example, and of course, everyone's going to say, "Oh, we would never do that." But they can per FEC. Let me read you from a little bit of this piece. Per FEC rules, there are some limits. Delegates are not allowed to accept funds and contributions from corporations, foreign nationals, labor organizations, or federal government contractors. But individuals are expressly allowed to raise funds for their travel to the convention and expenses there as long as they are not provided by prohibited sources. So the California Republican Party, they say here, says that potential delegates should expect to pay $3,000 to $6,000 on convention expenses. So there's some, you know, yeah, they're allowed to raise funds for their travel to the convention and expenses there. They can't accept funds and contributions of corporations, foreign nationals, labor organizations, or contractors. But this is kind of complicated. They say the RNC rules are not that clear on this for what exactly you're allowed to do. So I don't know if I'm a fancy Cleveland restaurant, which I'm sure there are some, and I'm right next to the convention. I got to figure it's going to be quite a bonanza. It's going to be a lot of stuff going on there. There are limits on what candidates can do. The federal code prohibits, this is again from a CNN piece, and I'm reading from it because I'm actually learning this, honestly, guys, on the spot here. I didn't know that there was so much. I knew that there would be some sort of bartering and discussion and you know, maybe promises of access and things like that. I didn't know it was quite so open-ended, though, but it's because for public officials, there's a pretty clearly established federal and even if you're a state-level official, i.e. Bob McDonnell in Virginia, you fall under the federal regulations for corruption and bribery. But if you're a delegate, you're not really a state government official. It's kind of like whatever the R, you know, it's kind of the RNC's issue, right? It's not, you're not considered to have the public trust. There's a lot more leeway is what I'm gathering here for this. And so here's some more from this, from the CNN legal analysis. There are limits on what candidates can do. The federal code prohibits candidates from promising appointments or employment for the purpose of procuring support in his candidacy. And another statute blocks rewards resulting from legislation or congressional action. And multiple provisions prohibit individuals from offering cash or things of value in exchange for votes in local and federal elections. But the catch, according to legal experts, is that a ballot at a party convention is not the same thing as a vote as a local in a federal election. So the convention is kind of a free-for-all. I don't think you can't accept cash, but you can accept a lot, probably. This is interesting. Nobody really knows what the full extent of this stuff is. There's not a lot of case law on it. That is interesting. And so, yeah, Esther from Texas, you raise a very interesting point. If anyone's going to be good at... You see, what Ted Cruz has been able to do so far is make his case to delegates about how he's more electable, he's the conservative, et cetera, right? But if it's going to be, you know, hey, who makes it rain up in here? Throws the cash, metaphorically speaking, all over the place. I think you can expect Donald Trump is going to be the guy who's most effective at that. And he's very good at, you know, when if Trump wants you to, I can tell you this, I met Trump years ago. On a personal basis, not as a pundit or whatever. I was like 14. I was a kid. If Trump wants you to like him, he's pretty good at getting you to like him in a person to person situation. He can be very charming. You know, he can be very funny, and he's going to be wooing these delegates, just as the Cruz campaign will be. And that's assuming we get to a contested convention, which I still think is going to happen. But can we all agree by that? I should put up a poll on Facebook so I really see what you think about this. Do any of you think that if Cruz loses Indiana, there's still a chance to block Trump? You look at a state like California, Trump is going to do very well in California. I mean, does anyone really doubt that? It's a very blue state. The kind of Republicans you get in California,
and I say this as a New York Republican, are more likely, in many cases, I think, to support Cruz than the kind of, you know, this is not, it's not Texas, it's not Oklahoma, it's not some of these states you can, that have gone for Cruz in big ways and have the conservative base as the sort of standard Republican voter, right? If you're a Republican in California, you're not necessarily, you may be, but you're not necessarily what would be considered the conservative base, right? And what counts as a GOP, or what makes someone sort of feel GOP in a place like New York City or a place like Los Angeles, I would be willing to bet is pretty distinct from what you could think of as a mainstream conservative base GOP voter, you know, across the South and into Texas and et cetera. So I don't know. I'll try to put up a poll on Facebook. So I'm really curious to see what all of you think about this. I really want to know if you think that Donald Trump wins in Indiana. Is it all over? Do you think it's not all over? I want to know. You tell me what you think. Speaking of California, we have our friend Mimi, who is calling from California. Mimi, great to have you in the Freedom Hut with me. It's been a while. How are you doing?
Hey, Buck. Shields high.
Shields high.
I wanted to I'm sorry about your voice, but you're right. You'd make a great jazz
right?
introducer.
Thank you, Mimi. I appreciate
NPR,
that.
So, although I really was hoping for Commie Beer.
Yeah, I know. He's coming back soon. But in the meantime, I've got a fantastic recipe for bacon-wrapped dates. And go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. In the meantime, you were talking earlier about the fact that, you know, the people want a king. And, of course, when you have a king, you want to make sure you're on the good side of a king. And the reason I bring that up is there's all of this talk about going after people who are denying climate change. And there's a new movie coming out. It's one night only. It's called The Climate Hustle. It's tonight. People can go to the website and find out where it's playing. It's in select theaters. And the whole focus of it is not only the fact about what's really going on with the climate, but it's also how they're persecuting all of the people who are denying, if you will, climate change. And they've got some scientists on there, even people who are from the left who have seen the light, and they're being persecuted as well. So we're getting into really scary times where there's a lot riding on this climate issue. There's a lot of big money involved in controlling us and controlling the environment. And they can't afford to have people start questioning. And I think that's a really scary place to be.
Yeah. Well, how do you watch this movie?
Okay. Well, you would go to Climate Hustle, the website Climate Hustle, and you can see it's in select theaters. So, you know, like Glenn does his Fathom events, it's a Fathom event. It's one night only. It's tonight on May 2nd. I think they'll probably sell a DVD afterwards, but it's a really, really good movie, and I think people, I would encourage Team Buck to try to go, or if they can't go, to, you know, to look it up later on and see if they can buy the movie. It's called Climate Hustle.
Okay. I will check it out. By the way, Mimi, since you're out in California, you know, give us your honest, I'm assuming, I feel like you've told me before, or maybe I'm just jumping to conclusions. I'm on a jump to conclusions, Matt. But I'm assuming you're a Cruz supporter. And is that correct?
Yes, I am a Cruz supporter.
Okay. Not to put you on the spot, Mimi, but, you know, I won't use your last name, promise. But how do you think California shakes out for Cruz and Trump based on everything you know about the state and the GOP there?
So there's the realistic version of that answer, and there's the hopeful version of the answer.
I want the realistic version, Mimi.
The realistic version is, you know, the statewide GOP is exactly what you said. I mean, it's pretty much rhino kinds of people. And
yeah,
that, I think, would lend itself more to Trump. I mean, the hopeful version is we had a really big Tea Party movement out here. A lot of recognition was never given to that, but we had a really big Tea Party movement. There are a lot of people who are fighting the Republican establishment and infiltrating, if you will, the Republican establishment and taking over at the county level a lot of these Republican areas. And so that's the hopeful version, is that those people are going to show up and actually vote. But I think realistically it's probably going to go for Trump.
Mimi, I knew you'd give us the straight scoop. Thank you, as always, for calling in and telling us about the climate change movie. Always good to talk to you, Mimi. Thank you. I went out, speaking of California GOP, I was out last fall speaking at the Newport Harbor Women's Republican Club. And so I was in Newport Beach. I could do that. I could go live in Newport Beach. That would be nice. Maybe I could set up the Freedom Hut there. It's very expensive, so I'd have to like find somebody who has a pool house for rent or something. But the Freedom Hut would be good in Newport Beach. And I had a great time talking to those ladies out there. They were conservative. They're coming up to me afterwards and they're like, "You stick it to this administration. You do not let them get it." I'm like, "That's right, madam. Absolutely." You know, they were great. I had great fun. That was really good. Yeah. Hey, for those of you out there who are from California, if you have like a GOP, I'll take any excuse to fly out to California and speak to a bunch of conservatives. So let me know. Make it happen. So total side note, perhaps non sequitur, but I haven't been to Cali in a while. Let's take Aaron in North Carolina. Aaron, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Welcome.
Hey, Buck. Thanks for having me. How are you doing today?
I'm good, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. Hey, Buck, I got a question for you. I was listening to you earlier, and you mentioned the Andrew Sullivan article about America being ripe for tyranny. And I'm a former U.S. Marine combat veteran, and I'm of the age now where I have teenage children. And my son actually brought the article to me. He was reading it on his phone. And, you know, we had a really interesting conversation about just the republic that we live in. And when voting no longer becomes your way to address grievances with the government, you know, at what point does the discussion of insurrection, you know, come into play? And not to sound like some kind of right-wing nut, but it seems like it always gets shot down. And, you know, everybody tempers themselves and says, hey, listen, you know, we don't ever need to get to that point. We have ways of, you know, voting out politicians that don't represent our interests. But it seems more and more that our interests are going away from our founding interests, and we find ourselves faced with a very new paradigm of what this country is becoming. And
Aaron, let me first say, thank you for your service, and also for your very thankful, very thoughtful question. Look, the point about insurrection—it's so interesting, isn't it? For example, it's illegal to advocate insurrection in this country, or to advocate for the overthrow. That's actually not protected under the First Amendment, right? So somebody going out on the street corner and saying overthrow the government would be violating. Would be violating the law, isn't it? Interesting, of course, because the founding fathers believed that, you know, they started an insurrection to get rid of the government, and now, of course, the government says, well, you know, sorry, no more insurrection talk. And I would say this about that: you're much more likely to see in the years ahead, widespread civil disobedience and nullification than you are to see anything else. I certainly never hope it goes to the point of insurrection. I do think. You will see, I think it's only a matter of time before you start to see some states that just feel like the federal yoke is far too heavy, and you'll have state and federal authorities clashing, certainly in the courts, and I hope it never goes anywhere beyond that. But I think, Aaron, refusal to comply is what you're more likely to see. I think that's much more in the American spirit right now, and that would be... certainly, as a first option, a much better choice than anything else. But it is concerning when you see that people are saying, oh, well, you know, one thing I will point out is that every time that there's violence at a Trump rally, people say, well, Trump is, you know, it's because of Trump's violent rhetoric. And I'm like, it wasn't the Trump people who were being violent necessarily. It was other people. Why is it Trump's fault that there are people showing up at Trump rallies and causing violence and getting into scuffs with the police? Right. I mean. You know, because so I just think it's very interesting the way that this stuff is often talked about. But Aaron, I mean, let me say that that's a question I'm going to continue to think about, and I wonder where it all goes, especially because we have a party that's so fragile. But thank you again for your service, and thank you for your thoughtful question. And I promise I'll spend more time on it as I go forward. Yeah, well, what happens if the government does? Look, the Second Amendment exists because we're worried that at some point the government will go tyrannical in a profound way. The government will become a tyranny. So that's why it's there, right? So there's not – to talk about these things in a theoretical sense is not beyond the pale at all. All right, I got to go to a break or I'm going to run over. I'll be back in a few. Stay with me. Oh, actually, before I go anywhere, team, Let me ask you something. Do you trust the NSA? Do you trust the CIA? Do you trust various federal agencies to not look at your emails? Well, look, even if you think that all the federal government stuff, all of its power is not being focused on you right now, it is known that third parties, Google and others, can use your information in whatever that way they want. That's their position in court. That's how they view their rights vis-a-vis the information you give them. That's why the answer is digital safe. You go to mydigitalsafe.com and they'll give you encryption for your emails, for your business documents, everything you need to keep secure. They will make sure it's covered. You can share a PIN with people that you want to have access to it. And beyond that, you don't have to worry about somebody else getting access to your private, personal, and business documents. So Digital Safe is located in Switzerland. You're like, why Switzerland? Well, it's not part of the EU and it's not under the auspices of the Patriot Act. When you, your family, and your business stores and your Digital Safe and the emails you send with Digital Safe, they're private, they are encrypted, and they are kept away from government snooping. Right now, Digital Safe has a special offer exclusively for you as a Blaze listener. Get 20% off at GetDigitalSafe.com. Your privacy is at GetDigitalSafe.com. Again, GetDigitalSafe.com. Be right back.
Buck Sexton. Dispensing the truth.
On the Blaze Radio Network. Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Hey, team, just a moment before we move on to some other topics. I'll probably circle back even what we were talking about before. I just want to say that I really appreciated, especially as I was homesick Saturday. And well, I had to work Saturday night at CNN, but then homesick all day Sunday. I really appreciated all the notes and the support. There were hundreds and hundreds of Facebook messages and emails. And, it was... I was overwhelmed. I mean, I don't know what else to say other than thank you so much. And that all of you who were with me as I talked about what's happened here at the Blaze on Friday, that you tell me things like you'll be with me in the Freedom Hut no matter what, always. There is no bigger compliment you can give me. There's nothing that makes me feel like I've accomplished more in my work than that. So thank you. And the emails and the notes and the Facebook messages and everything were really, really appreciated. And put a smile on this guy's face when he really needed one. All right, we're going to talk about some national security on the other side. A lot more show. Team Buck, stay with me.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
You're listening to The Buck Sexton Show,
only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Team, let's get into a Buck Brief.
You are entering the Blaze Threat Ops Center. This is a secure space. All outside comms are down. Prepare to receive the Buck Brief.
This weekend was the five-year anniversary of Osama bin Laden's death in 2011. The CIA had nearly 20 messages that it tweeted out reenacting for all of us the raid. 1:51 p.m. EDT, helicopters depart from Afghanistan for a compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan. 3:30 p.m., two helicopters descend on compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan. One crashes, but assault continues without delay or injury. It goes on, and then 3:53 p.m., POTUS receives tentative confirmation of positive identification of Osama bin Laden. And, of course, with that identification, they knew he was dead because he got a whole bunch of rounds pumped into him. What has it been like in the 5 years since? And what are we looking at now in the war against global jihadism? We're joined now by David Gartenstein Ross. He's a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. David, great to have you.
Thanks, Buck. It's great to join you.
So tell me what you think we've learned really about jihad, and then I want to get also what you think is sort of coming and what needs to be done going forward. But what have we learned in the 5 years since the UBL raid?
That's a great question. I think that today, 5 years later, we're not safer than we were. And in fact, the world is more perilous than it was 5 years ago with respect to the specific problem of jihadism. That, of course, is not because this raid was a bad idea. It was good to take out bin Laden, and it was a tactically brilliant raid, which is why CIA is basically, you know, live tweeting it 5 years later. A lot of the problem that we have today is caused by the mishandling of the Arab Spring. This overenthusiasm for revolutionary events in terms of what they would do to jihadism. And Michael Morell, who twice served as the acting director of CIA and was a
He was my boss for a while.
Yeah. So in his book, he writes about how CIA shared that enthusiasm. That's one of the analytic mistakes that he highlights. The belief that these raids shattered the narrative of Al-Qaeda. And in other places, at the time I was involved in these debates, both within and outside government, and could see just how powerful the view was, propounded by multiple agencies, multiple analysts, that these were devastating effects. But to me, one of the key events, the key mistakes that would help to propel jihadism had already been made by the time the bin Laden raid occurred. And that was the decision to go to war in Libya to topple Gaddafi and the destabilizing effect that that had and the way in which it helped to speed up the revolutionary events, which Al-Qaeda and ISIS were able to capitalize on.
Now, this seems to be something that we're finally seeing the culmination of the Obama administration's approach to the war on terror. There was this moment with the bin Laden raid, which is as we just discussed, was being really celebrated, quite honestly, by the CIA over the weekend. I mean, they rarely usually they tweet out, you know, something about an operation from like 1942 or whatever, when they weren't even the CIA, it was the OSS or 1945. I mean, you know, they tweet out really old classified information or some like, look at this pen that we used to use 50 years ago that had a knife in it. They actually were very enthusiastic about sharing information about the bin Laden raid. And there were some problems that came from that, which we won't get into today. People said that there actually was too much information shared. But nonetheless, the Obama administration did this. And then I think there was a sense among many that it was sort of game, set, match when it came to their counterterrorism policy. And now, as you've seen with the rise of the Islamic State, it obviously didn't deter jihadists from establishing safe havens, from recruiting, from really upping their digital recruitment game as well. I mean, their ability to use the internet for propaganda purposes has gotten stronger. ISIS being the best example of that. And I think it's a very easy argument to make, David, and I want your take on this, that the for those who believe that there is a struggle being waged between true believers within Islam who are jihadists and the rest of the world, they are in a better position now than they were while bin Laden was alive in 2011.
I think there's no question about that. It's not that there's a reasonable argument to be made. I think that's indisputable fact. And not only are jihadists better off, I'd say Al-Qaeda itself is better off. I want to talk about that in a second. But in terms of jihadism, I mean, the facts speak for themselves. Libya has never been able to reconstitute its government. It's essentially a failed state mired in civil war where ISIS controls a city, Sirte, and Al-Qaeda is deeply embedded in multiple areas. Tunisia is fundamentally threatened. Two major attacks to its tourism sector last year put the country on the brink, and they increasingly, especially in the western part of the country, face a jihadist insurgency. You have a jihadist insurgency in the Sahel that did not exist in 2011, with Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb having briefly captured northern Mali, and today northern Mali being more destabilized. You have much more jihadist activity in Egypt's Sinai region than before. You have ISIS's self-proclaimed caliphate stretching from Syria into Iraq. Yemen has collapsed, and Al-Qaeda today controls contiguous territory on the coastline. The only place, significant place, where the situation has gotten markedly better since 2011 is Somalia. And even with Somalia, where Shabaab has been pushed back from territory that it controlled, you have an extension of that jihad into Kenya, with increasingly deadly attacks like the Westgate Mall attack. So it's very clear that jihadism is better off. And even the what you talked about in terms of the game set match, the notion that al-Qaeda's senior leadership had met with a strategic defeat with bin Laden's death, that hasn't aged particularly well either. Today, al-Qaeda controls more territory when you look at Syria, when you look at Yemen, when you look at Libya, than it ever has. And frankly, that organization is probably pretty happy at the fact that ISIS is drawing the bulk of CT and COIN resources against it, while al-Qaeda has been able to slowly regroup. And you know, the fact that it controls as much territory as it does and nobody is alarmed is testament to just how much ISIS has shifted the focus of our attention.
I'm old enough to remember, David, being in the CIA and the notion that in a post 9/11 era that anybody would be okay from, you know, from CTC on up through the government, the Counterterrorism Center on to the rest of the military and intel apparatus, that anybody would ever think, oh, well, yeah, al-Qaeda, they control a city or two in Libya, and you know, they control some areas of Yemen, and they have some pieces of Syria, and they have bases of operation going on there, and that would sort of be an acceptable status quo, I think, has shown how far the goalposts have been moved by this administration. I mean, there was a time when, right, we were, you know, if there was a four-man cell somewhere saying they were al-Qaeda, we were going after them, right? I mean, and now it's like, well, maybe their external plotting will kind of slow down a little bit if we choke off their funds. I mean, that seems to be much more the approach.
Yeah, I mean, to use term that Glenn Beck popularized, ISIS has very much shifted the Overton window. It shifted the range of ideas that seem to be acceptable from a jihadist perspective. I mean, not only does al-Qaeda control territory in several countries, and we're not alarmed by that, but also increasingly al-Qaeda leaders are able to operate openly in places like Jordan, where the Jordanian government seems to be using Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi and Abu Qatada, who are two high-level al-Qaeda clerics, to try to get them to be a bulwark against ISIS's growth, since they're both anti-ISIS, to Mauritania, where you have high-level al-Qaeda theologians who are also out of prison. Al-Qaeda is receiving state support, and it's receiving state support very openly in Syria. Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Qatar are all funding Jaish al-Fatah, of which al-Qaeda's affiliate, Jabhat al-Nusra, is a leading part. So, I mean, all of these things, if in 2011, when bin Laden died, if we'd known that they were coming, or someone had rung the alarm to say that they're coming, they would simply not have been believed. I mean, the situation is far worse than literally anybody in the public sphere. Take the most alarmist predictions, and they're not as bad from the perspective of jihadism as where we are in 2016. And one
right. more thing, if you had said in 2011, after bin Laden's death, that there would be an explicitly and openly jihadist army with somewhere in the neighborhood of 30,000 to 50,000 men at arms that had effectively dismembered Syria and had taken a large portion of Syrian territory under its control, had invaded successfully Iraq, and had taken the largest Sunni Arab city in Iraq completely under its control, as well as other parts, other territories in Anbar and Nineveh provinces along the border, and would continue to hold that despite a coalition air campaign and despite the international community's sort of anemic efforts against it, but efforts nonetheless, people would have laughed at you. I think they would have been like, that's crazy. And to your point, that's not just our reality now. We're sort of always told that it's something that's not really our problem or not that big a deal, even though we know there's been external plotting that has occurred out of these areas, even after the massacres in Paris and Brussels. And that's actually where I wanted to transition and ask you, how do you think the Europeans are going to handle the fact that, I mean, I just saw a report, it was last week, I didn't get a chance to talk about it on air, that their belief is that there are ISIS cells that have used the migrant flow or have otherwise infiltrated back into Europe from Syria in many European countries, not just France and Belgium.
Yeah. So to get back to your comment and then answer your question, the funny thing is, while I agree with you that if you told them that would happen in Iraq and Syria, that you would have been laughed at, the interesting thing is that what you said there, in fact, understates the case, right? It doesn't mention Libya. it doesn't mention Yemen. It
doesn't mention Boko Haram, its allegiance. Yeah, it doesn't mention Afghanistan, where they all – yeah, you're right.
Right. So the thing is that no matter what you would have said in 2011, it wouldn't have captured just how much worse the situation has grown by 2016. And external ops is one of those where a cell of this magnitude, what we saw in Brussels and Paris – 5 years ago, people would have said that it was impossible. And I think 5 years ago, they would have been right, because part of this is the post-Snowden world, where not only do jihadists have a better idea of how electronic surveillance occurs, but also in response to Edward Snowden's revelations, you have a massive explosion in end-to-end encryption, which we know that these groups have used in Europe. A cell that not only carries out the Paris attacks, with 9 attackers slaughtering over 100 people, but then the full weight of European intelligence and security is brought down on them, and they're able to survive to carry out another catastrophic attack. That's the kind of thing that has never happened before in Europe. It's the kind of thing that people would have said was impossible 5 years ago. Now, in terms of the use of the migrant flows, I was recently talking to some U.S. government officials who told me that actually when they speak to their European counterparts, often some of those European counterparts, they didn't tell me from what countries, are incredulous or don't believe that the migrant flows are being used this way.
Now,
it's surprising to me because the evidence is very clear that the migrant flows have been used to bring operatives in. I look at a couple of problems that interrelate.
We've got about a minute, DV, then we got to go, but go ahead.
Sure. One is the use of the migrant flows. The other one is just the general explosion of foreign fighters and radicalism in Europe. What I think they need to do is to use the Al Capone model of anti-terrorism policing to go after the bad guys for anything they can get them on, whether it's financial crimes, and it doesn't have to necessarily be terrorism.
All right. David Garten-Seaton Ross, he's a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. David, where's your latest? Where can we read it?
The latest is in Jamestown, which actually looks at the shape of the ISIS terrorist networks in Europe.
Fantastic. Go, everyone, check it out. David, great to have you on. Thank you for your time.
Always a pleasure. You take care.
Team Buck, much more coming. Stay with me.
Buck Sexton.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Sexton Show.
So, team, on Facebook.com/Buck Sexton right now, I have a poll up. The options are as follows. The question first, then the options. What should Ted Cruz do if Donald Trump wins the Indiana primary tomorrow? The options are fight on, shields high, no retreat, no surrender. Stay in the race, but it's just a formality, it's over. Concede to Trump, start wearing a red Make America Great Again hat, bail on America, join Commie Bear on his Caspian Sea yacht. So 2/3 of you right now who have voted say that he should stay in it and fight on no matter what. No retreat, no surrender. Ted Cruz, even if he loses in Indiana, he needs to stay in the race because who knows what's going to happen in California. About a third, less than a third, 20, let's call it 26% as I see it right here. But close to a third of you either want him to stay in the race but think it's over or figure that he should back Trump. Start wearing a red Make America Great Again hat. Let me tell you, I don't think Ted Cruz is ever going to be walking around with a red MAGA hat on, but maybe. Am I the only one who says MAGA, by the way? Is that a thing that we can say now? Make America Great Again? What? That's my thing. Okay. MAGA. I mean, I just hope it's not like a curse in a foreign language. I don't know. But MAGA, Make America Great Again. We got to have an acronym, you know? So anyway, MAGA hat, 18% of you. And bail on America, join Commie Bear. Almost 10% of you think that he should just join Commie Bear on the Caspian Sea yacht. So that's also an option. All right, team, back in a little bit.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network. spreading freedom across the nation. This is
3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to Hour 3 in the Freedom Hut. Great to have you here. We're joined now by our friend Maggie Mulvaney. She's a Republican strategist. Maggie, thanks for calling in. Apologies for my scratchy voice today.
Sorry that you're not feeling so well. Thanks again for having me.
No worries. I've got some hot tea in here. I'll be okay. So, Maggie, let's do a little preview of what you can expect tomorrow, or what we can expect tomorrow for the Indiana primary. Going into this thing, who do you feel like has the momentum? I mean, the latest polling that I've seen shows Donald Trump, this is an NBC Wall Street Journal Marist poll, shows Trump ahead 15 points. I feel like it's going to be a lot tighter than that. But what do you think?
I think I agree with you. It's going to be tighter than what it seems. Cruz has a lot of the pressures on for him coming off of two big losses with New York and the Northeastern primaries. That being said, though, he just had the VP pick, Carly Fiorina, come out with him, as well as Governor Pence's endorsement that should help him that close that margin of the 15%.
You think the Carly pick, because this was kind of controversial. I mean, I actually, when I was at CNN over the weekend, there were some jokes being made offset by various pundits about, yeah, like, why doesn't he appoint his, you know, Secretary of the Treasury, too? And, like, why not roll out the Surgeon General while he's at it? I mean, this was sort of there was a bit of, you know, these were Democrats, mind you. There's a bit of mocking going on. But you think Carly has added a sort of, a seriousness to the ticket? The female vote may perhaps be more inclined to go with Ted over Trump? What's your take on that aspect?
I think from a strategy point, it deflected on his losses in the Northeastern primaries last week, changed the narrative, changed the news story, and that I think helped him in the end of the day. I'm not sure if she adds a ton of value to the ticket or not. I think he could have, if he wanted to win a Midwestern state, I personally would have picked a Midwestern person, whether that been the governor, Pence, trying to team up with Kasich, Walker, and he could have attempted that and it was not successful. But I don't
so it's a news cycle. It's a news cycle thing. It changes the news cycle in a way that's favorable for the Cruz campaign, which helps with momentum going in.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, but what's your take? The polls show right now, and you know the audience listening right now, I would roughly estimate is 70% pro Cruz, but the rest is pro Trump. But the polls going into tomorrow show Trump winning substantially. If he does win, let's say by a 10-point margin, just theoretically, what do you think the Cruz campaign stays in no matter what, right? I mean, they're going to see this thing through to California and maybe at that point make a final determination. Is that your sense of where this is all heading?
Yes, it's all about delegate counts. So even if Trump wins tomorrow, which I do think he will win, it's just a question of how much, you know, 30 delegates are who win statewide, but then the rest of the delegates are broken up by congressional district. And that's the rules of the game right now. And Trump, I know, bashes that, but that's the rules of the game. That's the same thing with California. It's based on who wins the congressional district, and they each get the same amount, which each congressional district can win. Nancy Pelosi's district doesn't have a ton of Republicans, so the 20 people that come out for, let's say, Cruz in this sense, which I don't know who's polling well, he could get the same amount of delegates as a different congressional district that is an overwhelmingly Republican district. It's all about the delegate game right now. I think Cruz's sell of himself losing Indiana, if he were, that gets harder and harder, harder uphill battle for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. But do you think that there will be any chance? Because I was asked this today by somebody who was wondering if I would come on and talk about this on a show. One of the producers emailed me and they're like, hey, where are we here with consolidation of the GOP? I feel like Democrats watch this whole thing playing out between Trump and Cruz, and they've got to love it, right? Because the rhetoric that's being used is so much nastier and more personal than what you see between Hillary and Bernie. Plus, Hillary's already the nominee, and everyone knows it now, so it doesn't really matter what Bernie says. But this very tight, very tense battle between Trump and Cruz looks like it's leading to, whether it's sooner or later, later being at the convention, a real fracture within the party. Do you think that there'll be, you know, if it's Trump or Cruz that ends up as the nominee, is there any chance really of a consolidation of the party against Hillary? Or are we looking at limping into the general election no matter what?
I think A small limp, if that makes sense. I think if it's Trump, everyone's going to have to figure out a way to get behind him just because of the process of having the House and the Senate. You're going to have to work together. If it's Cruz, I wouldn't be surprised if Trump went third party. He's going to argue that all these states went for him, that they deserve to have him as their voice. So I think if Trump is the nominee, people are going to have to figure out how to. I think they will slowly but surely. But if Cruz were the nominee, I think it'll be harder for the Republican base to get behind Cruz. Yes. But for the people that voted for Trump, it's going to be a lot harder to get behind the Republican nominee, being that so many people are coming out for the first time ever voting and they're voting for Trump.
What do you make of these polls that just came out that showed Trump? It was just the Rasmussen poll that shows Trump beating Hillary nationally.
I think his tone is starting to change. I think he's starting to sound more presidential. He just gave a foreign policy speech last week that sounded more presidential. His tone is changing, even with Governor Pence versus Governor Walker. When Governor Walker endorsed Cruz for president in Wisconsin, he bashed him and he bashed his policies. When Governor Pence endorsed Cruz for in Indiana, he changed his tone. He was very nice about it. He said he's voting for him, but he likes the guy. So I think his tone is starting to change. It's not so negative. It's not so just cutting everyone out.
But and you can foresee a situation where Trump runs the kind of campaign where he could beat Hillary in the long term. You don't think that's crazy talk?
No, not at all. I think he can beat Hillary.
All right. So you'd be comfortable supporting either candidate as a Republican?
Yes, I would. I'm a never Hillary person. I not really have a horse in the race right now between the two. But you still have a process of the House, which I'm confident that the House of Representatives is going to stay Republican. The Senate has a harder battle, but I still think that they're going to stay Republican, that you'd rather have a Republican in the House that you agree with 85%, let's say, versus a Democrat that you agree with less than 50. So
yeah.
I would support Trump.
I'm never Hillary, too, so we got that in common. Maggie Mulvaney, she is a Republican strategist. You all can follow her and team, I recommend you do, on Twitter, at Maggie Mulvaney. Maggie, we really appreciate it. Thank you for calling in today.
Thanks so much.
All right, team, the phone lines are open, 888-900-3393. Jim in Indiana. Give us some of that Indiana ground truth, Jim. The Hoosier State.
Well, the truth of the matter is I'm scared to death.
of what?
I'm one of the never Trump people, and I can tell you exactly why. I figure if it comes down to Hillary and Trump, in 2 years, whichever one gets elected, it's going to be so hated that the other party is going to take complete control of the House and Senate and perhaps even veto-proof. So in that regard, I would rather have Hillary as the president if we're going to be stuck with one of the two.
Well, you're not alone there. I've had people on the show. I've had pundits on the show who take the position that they'd rather it be Hillary because at least there's something for conservatives to oppose. That's not my perspective, but that is a perspective that plenty of people share. But, Jim, can you give us some sense of what, as an Indiana resident, I'm sure you're talking to friends and paying attention to what's being covered there on the news. And Indiana's getting a lot of focus right now across the country because of how important it is to the primary. Do you think Indiana goes for Trump or goes for Cruz?
Well, I'm hoping he goes for Cruz. I was talking to my brother last week, and he said he was anybody but Cruz. I'm going to be calling him this evening, and we're going to discuss that.
Yeah, you're going to set him straight, huh?
I am truly afraid of Trump. I really, really am. I do want to say, I think it seems like a swing happened when Bobby Knight came out and endorsed him. I've talked to people that have just said, I can't believe he did that. And I've talked to other people that think so highly of Knight that it's actually swinging their view.
Knight is still a big draw in Indiana. People care what Bobby Knight has to say. I can't say I've ever been to Indiana, so my knowledge is slim.
I'm a Purdue graduate, so I don't like him at all. But
I got you. Yeah, that's right. Get that guy.
But I would like to say just off that topic a bit, though. So glad that you came on at noon. I used to listen to you on Saturday and wish the heck you were on every day. And I wanted you to know that ever since you came on, I have not listened to Rush Limbaugh except when you were guest hosting there.
Well, you are very kind, sir, and that is a very high compliment, and I greatly appreciate it, especially these days. I can use the encouragement. Jim from Indiana, thanks so much for calling in, man. I really appreciate it. It's great to talk to you. Let's take one more. We got an Indiana caller. We got a California caller. We're hitting all the places we need on the primary map. Ed in California, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Welcome.
How you doing, Buck? Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure,
first
sir.
Off, I have to tell you, you kind of got that Wolfman Jack sound going today. That's kind of cool.
Thank you. I'm hoping the ladies like it. You know what I mean? I should call some and say, hey, who wants to go out for drinks on Friday with the Buck Man? Go ahead.
Yes, sir. But no, with Indiana, do you really think it's going to matter if Trump wins Indiana and California? I mean, even if he hits a 1237, I really don't think it's going to matter. The RNC,
what do you mean?
However they want.
Oh, you think even if he hits 1237, they may not do it?
They can change the rules as they want. It used to be 50 plus one, you know, 50% plus one, you know, and they might say, no, I think we need 55.
Ed, I can't tell you definitively that won't happen, but I can tell you I think that would be, oh man,
I think
that would be
a huge mistake. But man,
yeah. I don't see it happening. I mean, that I put that in the bin with Hillary getting indicted and saving the GOP from itself. I don't see that happening. I can't imagine that if Trump gets to 1237 and they don't give him the nomination. Look, at that point, I would say it's unfair, right? I mean, I'd be like, hey, guys, sorry, you know, if Trump wins, Trump wins. Okay, we're not like the East German judges in the Olympics in like the early 80s or something here. You know what I'm saying? Like we're trying to keep it relatively fair. We're trying to do what's right by the rules. And so, no, I'd have to say you got to give Trump the nomination if he gets 1237 on that first ballot. And we're going to have a talk. We're going to have a continuing conversation here in the Freedom Hut about, you know, what we do at that point, because I don't know. I know a lot of people say they're never Trump. We'll have to see kind of how we feel if it turns out Trump's the nominee. But what's going on in California, Ed? I mean, what are you seeing there? I'm always curious, people, because like I knew, for example, as a New Yorker, that Trump was going to clobber everybody else in New York. But it was obvious, right? California is not as obvious.
Well, I'm an original New Yorker, too. And when I come out here, I couldn't believe what I saw. You know, it's just, it was like Halloween every day. But
you mean the politics? I'll never forget being in San Francisco, and there was a guy selling paintings of Osama bin Laden on a surfboard going under the Golden Gate Bridge. And I was like, this place is just bizarro land. But anyway, go ahead.
I don't belong here. I'm from upstate New York, population about 5,000, you know, whatever. But when I first came out here, it was nuts. And now with what was going on with these protests down in Burlingame and Costa Mesa, they were burning flags. They were actually stealing flags from Trump protesters and then burning them in front of them. That's not protesting. That's not a legal protest. That's not freedom of speech. And I put that on my webpage, you know, my Facebook page. And all these liberals all of a sudden jumped all over me. Well, that's just freedom of speech. That's, you know, jumping on cop cars and trying to tip cop cars over and writing on cars that are going by because you're blocking the roads. That's not freedom of protest. That's a violation of these people's civil rights. Now, I'm looking for a kind of a Trump rally when it gets up here, somewhere closer to me. I'm closer to Stockton than I am down there. And
all right.
I want to go. I want to go because not that I'm supporting Trump, I'm supporting freedom of speech. And burning stuff down and tearing things up, that's not freedom of speech.
I hear you, my friend. All right, well, thank you. Go ahead. We got to go into a break. We lost him. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Ed, but we got to go into a break. Team 888-900-3393, much more. Come and stay with me.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The Blaze Radio Network.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
Mark in Montana, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Welcome, sir.
Hi. Oh, my goodness. I'm so nervous. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed, sir. You sound great. What's up?
Oh, sorry. All the talk about, like, Indiana now and stuff, and I'm from Montana. Oh, thanks for the birthday card you sent a couple years ago. Nobody ever talks about us unless it's, like, some sort of racist or Unabomber thing. And
you mean Montana?
So my friend. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm a little nervous, so a little scatterbrained.
Don't be nervous. We're just talking. What's up? Go ahead.
People just, like I said, we're forgotten. You know, most of my friends don't bother to vote because, like, why? Montana, you know, it's just sort of, you feel non-existent.
Yeah.
So it's sort of frustrating, but, especially because by the time it gets here, usually it's decided. So
are you just calling us to tell us you feel like Montana doesn't get enough love in the primary? Is that is that the thesis here?
I guess.
I guess.
I've never
okay.
been to Indiana, so I really don't know what it's like there.
So it's okay. I understand. You're speaking on behalf of Montanans, and you're saying you're jealous of Indiana because they're getting all this love right now. And Montana, for all I know of Montana is everyone says how beautiful it is and how, you know, there's like lots of land and it's cheaper to live up there. If you like outdoor stuff, it's great. Mark from Montana, I think we're going to leave it there, though. Thank you very much for calling in, man. It was nice to talk to you. Mark's like, yo, where's the love for Montana? I don't know. It's a good question. Why isn't Montana getting the love? Should, you would think. By the way, there was a piece. Where did it go now? Somebody I think it was Carol. I forget her name. I'll say it on the other side. Oh, by the way, wait. I have one correction. Climate Change Movie.com, I think. Somebody told me is the name of the actual site for that Climate Change movie. All right. So I think it was it Carol Markowitz? I got to find it. But she wrote a piece about how there's a restaurant that she goes to on the weekend. She's a New York Post columnist. And I read this over the weekend. She says that the restaurant has a children must remain seated during the meal rule. I want to go to this restaurant. I want to, like, do everything I can to support this restaurant. I think it's out in Long Island, so I probably won't get the chance. But this should be, I mean, this idea, this is a total diversion, I know, everybody. But I just feel like I'm not just imagining it. It's just turning into pandemonium these days. People think that, you know, I was having a drink with a friend from another media company, sort of like a happy hour time, at a very crowded bar. And there are people in there who have babies and strollers, and the babies are crying. There are two of them. The babies are crying. I was like, this is like a professionals drinking after work kind of a scene. You know, what's with the babies right now? And it's fine to have the babies there, I guess, but I mean, the babies are crying and making a lot of noise, and like nobody really wants to hear it, you know? I mean, bottom line. And she says in her piece, as a mom, she's a mother of three, so she gets the, I just sound like the cranky single man who's like never going to figure his life out. But the writer in this piece, Carol, in the New York Post, says she's a mother of three, and that when the baby starts making too much noise, it's on, you know, look, on a plane, I get it, right? On a plane's a plane, you can't go anywhere, baby crying. That's why you get noise-canceling headphones. You know, everyone's got to suck it up. It's no one's fault. But in a restaurant, you know, yeah, baby needs to be taken outside the restaurant. I'm sorry. I mean, that's if the baby can't behave. And with kids who can, like, obey commands, I know it makes it sound like I'm the commandant here or something, the kids must obey commands. But this, let your kids wander around. And the biggest thing for me is the using the iPads with volume on them and using that as sort of a babysitter and thinking that it's okay. Like, I don't want to hear SpongeBob SquarePants when I'm sitting down at a restaurant. I just don't. And I'm talking about restaurants where, like, I'm kind of wondering, why are kids here in the first place? It's like Saturday night at 9 p.m. Like, get a sitter or order in. This is New York City. I know I get a little get off my lawn about this stuff, but we are, you know, this is civilized people that we're talking about here. You know, this is the way it's supposed to be. Manners matter, you could say. All right, I got a lot more coming, Team Buck. Stay with me on the flip side.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Buck Sexton Show.
So, team, I just wanted to bring you into my world for a second here over the weekend. Not the part of it where I was just coughing and sick all day yesterday, because that's not fun. But on Saturday, I was over at CNN covering the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which I went to some years ago. And which I have to say is, well, the best part of it is the after party, that's for sure. I'm just not somebody who likes, and I've been to a fair amount of these kinds of things because they're frequent, you know, happenings in New York. I'm just not somebody who particularly loves the idea of showing up at an event and being all, you know, having to sit at a table for hours. And I mean, maybe if I was like at the cool table at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and I was hanging out with, I think Will Smith was there, Bryan Cranston was there. I mean, it's become a thing where like real celebrities go. It used to be like some sort of celebrities go, and now it's like straight up celebrities are there. But I don't like when you only have two options when it comes to food. I mean, I don't like the whole thing. Like, I'm not a banquet kind of a guy usually, unless one of you wants to invite me to your group to come speak somewhere. Then I love banquets. Then banquets are fantastic. But in terms of me being in the audience, I'm not somebody who particularly enjoys that. So I went a few years ago. I was super bored. I didn't even make it to Obama's speech. I just left because I didn't care and it was boring, and went to some of the after parties, which got started earlier than the event ended. Anyway, so I was up there and I'm on the stage with, you know, CNN stage here in New York. So like I said, journalists covering a journalism event. It's very meta. And I'm up there and I'm there. The other people on the stage are Kayleigh McEnany, who, you know, they always put under me now crew supporter, which, okay, but I need to see if every time a Democrat comes on TV, do they put Hillary supporter under their name? I mean, I need to look into that, because that would be basically everybody who's not a Cruz or a Trump supporter, with a few exceptions of Bernie Sanders supporters. But I think people get away with being, you know, Democrat strategists or just being political. You can just be a political analyst and be a total hack for Hillary. But if you're a Cruz supporter or a Trump supporter, it's sort of stamped on your forehead all the time. This is, you know, these are the subtle things. Look, networks are allowed to do what they want, but subtle differences in the way that the right and the left are treated at these places. So, although maybe I'm wrong, maybe Hillary supporters are always, I'll have to pay closer attention next time. Anyway, so I'm up there. And then they had a number of people who are, and then the Mark Lamont Hill is a Democrat, and they had a couple of other people whose names I quite honestly don't remember, who were comedians of, not comedians themselves, but sort of comedic writers or involved in comedic projects, from Funny or Die, and the creator of The Daily Show was there. So we're all on stage, and you know, this is not really my, I mean, look, I could talk about anything, honestly, and to some, like, within reason, right? And talking about a bunch of journalists dressing up and pretending not to think that they're fancy, but they think they're really fancy. Yeah, sure, I could handle it. Anyway, and I'm on contract at CNN, so I went over there and I did this because, you know, I'm a good contract person. You know, I uphold my end of the bargain, and so I'm over there. I'm doing this whole CNN thing, and I watch, and we're talking about all the stuff, and you can imagine. And first of all, just as a side note, there was a piece the Free Beacon has that, you know, this is the White House Correspondents' Dinner. It's sort of supposed to be for people who cover the White House, and then it's grown into this just giant media extravaganza. The Free Beacon has a piece that not a single White House reporter is a Republican. About a quarter of them are registered Democrats. And I mean, the ones who aren't registered or independent, I mean, they're all Democrats. So pretty much there's not a single registered Republican right now. And 9 out of 10 of them think that Hillary Clinton is going to be the next president in a survey they did. So this gives you, when people talk about, oh, the media's biased or whatever, this isn't just something that people say. It's quite obviously, manifestly true. The media is completely in the tank for Hillary. Interesting, the media in particular is really not pro-Bernie. There are celebrities who are pro-Bernie, and there are people who will get out there and who will be Bernie, sort of Bernie pundits. But the mainstream media is all in for Hillary. That's just the way it is. The celebrities and the cool people are in for Bernie, but that's all going to change because Hillary's going to win. But if you're a journalist in D.C., you're all about Hillary Clinton and you think that she's great and wonderful and the Republicans are a bunch of Neanderthals and they're idiots. Okay. So I'm at this event and you know, you had the, and I'm in a funky spot, right? Because it's, You got the Democrat president speaking, Obama. It's his last time he's doing this event. Yeah. And you've got a stage essentially full of Democrats, except for Kayleigh, who's next to me as a Trump supporter. And, you know, what can you do? You don't want to be the guy who's just like, oh, Obama's terrible, whatever. So I put on my objective, is this entertaining hat? And I will tell you that I thought that, yeah, in fact, Obama was funny. And it was a reminder to me of how this guy managed to win two elections. The first time around, it was the power of narrative. The second time around, you know, Romney, you could criticize him all day, but Obama does have a certain, to people who are center and center left, there's a charisma there, and he gives a good speech. You know, yeah, he needs a prompter, but he gives a good speech nonetheless. And I was like, okay, this is, and he's a charismatic figure that people voted for. And I get it, right? I disagree with it, but at least it may, you know, with Hillary, it's just like, there's no charisma. It's just, she's the Democrat machine. So you're just voting for, a vote for Hillary is just a vote for the sort of mainstream Democratic Party. That's really what it comes down to. But he gave a speech, and there were some funny parts to it. He even made some jokes about Hillary. Play clip four.
Bernie's slogan has helped his campaign catch fire among young people. Feel the burn. Feel the burn. It's a good slogan. Hillary's slogan has not had the same effect. Let's see this.
I forget what the slogan was, guys. I'm sorry. So, you know, look, everyone thought it was funny.
I said how much I admire Hillary's toughness, her smarts, her policy.
Do you know what it says, Ty?
Her experience. You've got to admit it, though. Hillary trying to appeal to young voters is a little bit like your relative who just signed up for Facebook. Yeah. Dear America, did you get my poke? Is it appearing on your wall? I'm not sure I'm using this right. Love and Hillary.
Look, it was funny. Okay, it was. He said funny stuff. I mean, Hillary has like a new relative on Facebook. These are funny. These are funny things to say. It was amusing, and I give credit where it's due. This is one of the things. I mean, I go over to CNN, and I think sometimes this is to my detriment when it comes to cable news in general. Because I'm willing to be objective about things, right? I mean, yeah, I'm a partisan in the sense I'm open about my biases, but when I see something as being true, even if I wish it weren't, I'll say it's true. Or I can also put it aside and say, yeah, I mean, if you're asking me if something's funny, I'll tell you if it's funny. It doesn't matter what the politics necessarily are. Obama crushed it. I mean, he did a really good job in the speech. And I know you're kind of like, Buck, why are you telling us about this? Well, we're about to get into the other side of this in a second. Because he wasn't the only one to give a speech. He did a really good job. It was really funny. There were some really good lines. And my favorite line, actually, which we don't have a clip of, was he made a joke about Goldman Sachs and how he's going to be, you know, making all that money by speaking to Goldman Sachs after he's done being president. And, you know, that was a real joke. And it was the sort of thing that I didn't know that he'd actually go there with Hillary. You know, I didn't know that he'd actually make any jokes that really would sting. Of course, he didn't mention the emails or anything like that. But nonetheless, he made some comments that were he was funny. And I said he was funny. We'll get to why that matters in a second. Then you had Larry Wilmore come on. Now, Larry Wilmore, I've never thought was funny personally. I've seen his show a few times and only a few times because I find it painful. I think a lot of the racial humor he does is not funny at all. And look, racial humor can be its own phenomenon. I mean, you look back at the Chappelle show, for example, which had a lot of racial humor and racial commentary. And later on, I actually saw Dave Chappelle as a comedian live a couple of times, I think. Definitely once. I think I saw him twice, but I can't remember. It was years ago. And Dave Chappelle's hilarious. And he was a complete phenomenon. And he made jokes later on in stand-up about how the Chappelle show was so successful that, like, white teenagers were running up to him in front of his kids and were, like, quoting all of his lines. And, I mean, you know, it was something that no one had to tell anybody the Chappelle show was funny because people thought it was funny. Right? And there was a reason why Comedy Central was going to write him a check for, I remember hearing it was like $50 million for another season or two of the show. because it was like I said, a cultural phenomenon. So the racial humor can be really funny, and it was just really clever. And you know, people obviously have mentioned there's some of the sketches that he did, that Chappelle did, have been things that people still to this day will sort of turn on for their friends and think. Anyway, Larry Wilmore is just not in that league. He's just not as funny to me. I mean, this is an opinion thing. Fine. I also like whenever people are asked for their opinion and someone on the stage, and this happened Saturday night, we'll start going, well, that's just your opinion. It's like, yeah, that's what we're doing here. We're giving our opinions. So saying it's just my opinion is not a counterpoint, nor is it an intelligent thing to say. But I digress. But Wilmore went after Ted Cruz in a very big way. Play clip one.
So there's a joke going around the internet that Ted Cruz is actually the Zodiac killer, right? I'm not making that up, you know? Come on, that's absurd. You know, some people actually liked the Zodiac killer. Recently, Ted Cruz got a string of wins and endorsements, and then everybody remembered who Ted Cruz is, the Zodiac killer. Ted Cruz got 0 delegates in New York, which is actually 5 more than I thought he would get for the Zodiac killer. John Boehner came out of retirement and described Ted Cruz as Lucifer in the flesh. Lucifer. I mean, that is not fair, man. Lucifer is horrible, but he's not the Zodiac killer.
I mean, talk about beating a dead horse with that. I mean, it wasn't funny the first time, and to repeat it over and over again, it was just unfunny. And it also is a perfect example of the difference between, you know, what passes for humor on the, you know, or the sort of thing that comedians on the left will say about people on the right. You know, they'll make jokes about Hillary as though she was like a member of their family, right? They'll make jokes, but they won't. And this is true almost across the board with sort of well-known comedians. They won't go after, though. They won't really impugn Hillary's integrity or anything else. They won't talk about how her voice is horrible and she's a liar and she's for sale and she helped her husband trash women after he had used them like disposable objects. And they won't make jokes about that. But with Ted Cruz, they'll compare him to a serial killer. It was just deeply unfunny, and it was disrespectful, and it wasn't cool at all. And then there were some other, and I won't play them here on the show, but there were some other things that he said that were, you know, he used racial words. He even, you know, he busted out. I mean, you can hear it for yourself if you want. It was horrifically unfunny. What I thought was so interesting, though, is that so we finished this thing, and here I am. Here's Mr. Crew supporter, Buck Sexton. You know, he's even got a side part and everything. Look at him. Just looks like some smug Republican, you know, smug CIA guy. Just thinks he knows stuff and, you know, whatever. Part of the Bilderbergs, the conspiracy. And I'm sitting up there, and I'm like, you know, Mr. GOP, you know, I'm like the, what do you call the guy who shows up the wrestling match who's supposed to lose? Is it a jobber? A jobber, yeah. I'm like, when it comes to this stuff, I'm talking about Obama's speech. I'm basically a jobber. I'm basically there if I step out of line to get beat up on. But actually, I said it. We come right after the speech finishes, we come back, and I'm like, look, bottom line is that Obama was just funnier, and his speech was just better than Wilmore's in every respect, including Obama being a better comedian. And, oh, man, all the comedians, I love this, dude. Comedians, you know, at least these comedians, well, at least one of them, very quick to be like, well, I'm the expert here, so your opinion doesn't count. And as I was saying to Ty before the break, you know, you can be a chef and know more about me than cooking, but if you give me crap food, I know that it's crap food. I don't need you to explain to me that the food is really good, okay? And this was the equivalent. If Larry Wilmore was a chef, he basically put out, you know, a complete mess on the plate. It was terrible. And it was funny because the other leftists on the stage, and that was all but me and all of Kelly and me, the leftists on the stage were all in favor of Wilmore. Oh, Wilmore's great. He's so funny. I thought he crushed it. He was better. They're saying he's better than Obama. Here I am, the guy who spent the 5 years that he's worked in media explaining how Obama is hurting the country and his policies are terrible and nonsensical and he's dishonest and everything. But the guy was funny, and I'll say it. And I got this whole group of people that know that it's cooler to say that Wilmore was funnier. And then they showed the CNN opinion polls that they were taking of people watching this and everything from across the country. And 90% of CNN's audience thought that Obama was funnier. And 60% of the CNN audience I was watching, and as you know, it's mostly Democrats,
didn't think Wilmore was funny at all. So there you have it. Buck lays it down, and the American people agree. We'll come back after the break.
Buck Sexton. The Blaze Radio Network. Sexton.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Well, team, it's a big day tomorrow for sure in politics. That much we can all agree on. Indiana, is this the moment that the tide turns for Cruz or for Trump? We shall see. It is certainly going to be a big day on the political scene. Again, I want to thank you all for the kind messages over the weekend that really did bring me some much-needed cheer. So thank you. I read all of them. I responded to a lot of them, as many of them as I could. Join me again here tomorrow on the Freedom Hut Live at 12 Eastern. And please tell a couple of friends. Let's grow Team Buck, everybody. Shields high.
Buck Sexton.
On the Blaze Radio Network.